right. I need to resize my window here so I can see everybody. All right. Welcome, everyone. I will go around and say hello to people. I think I can see everybody on my one screen. I am out of town at a cottage owned by a friend. So I'm in Southern Oregon right now. But good internet connection. I think we're going to be fine. I'll start by saying hello to Bob and Sandy. Andy. Katie. Susan. Mick. Peter, Paulette, Jim, Phil, Linda R, Yeshe Soki, Tyler, Mark, John, Shoketsu, Pat, Marv, Jeffrey, Joseph, Randy, Amelia, Kurt, and Ruth Ann. I think that's everyone, unless the images shuffled while I was reading. So, yeah, let's see. In terms of announcements, we have our annual retreat starting August 23rd. You can participate in that online. We hopefully, probably, unless things change drastically with regard to COVID, we will be having an in-person option for participation, obviously, if you're near enough. And we need require full vaccination and we'll be wearing masks, unfortunately, going back to that. But it should be sweet to participate. You can participate part-time in person, then do some of it online or whatever. But I really encourage you, if you have the option of setting aside either the whole time, there's a Monday through Saturday morning, if you have that whole time to set aside, or a day or two, or certain parts of each day, it can be a really wonderful practice. I think that's about it. Can anybody, any questions about upcoming stuff? Right. And there's a Sangha picnic, August 14th, Saturday. I guess that's next Saturday. And a term student program coming up as well. So please check the email newsletter for more information about that stuff. Any questions or other things that I should mention? Okay. All right. So today's talk, I'm calling Unconditional Strength and Gratitude, the Medicine of Suchness. So the title that I put in the newsletter, I mentioned emptiness, but I'm going to call it suchness instead, and I'll explain that later on. So the gist of this is that even the most fortunate human life inevitably involves suffering. That's the main Buddhist teaching. Old age, disease, and death, you know, even if on the balance, we are very fortunate, it's going to involve suffering. And sometimes, of course, we face terrible things that arouse great anxiety, depression, fear, despair, rage, trauma. And our climate and ecological emergency is one of those terrible things that is bringing us just face to face with just, incomprehensible loss. So, that's a great reason to do Zen practice, because our practice offers us a life-saving medicine that can alleviate our despair and help us access strength and gratitude, unconditional strength and gratitude. So that is the gist of today's talk. But before I get to that, I want to take a moment to bear witness to something happening in the world. So I want to make a practice of always addressing additional aspects of our practice. So if we think of our practice as having three parts, the bearing witness, exposing ourselves to the suffering that's happening in the world, taking care of ourselves, and that includes our spiritual practice. So a lot of what we do, a lot of what we're doing together as Sangha and in Zen is taking care. And then taking action, although I had some good conversations this weekend with friends, and I'm starting to thinking that it should be called getting engaged instead of taking action. But more on that later. I won't go into that today. But I wanted to take a moment to bear witness before we begin. So what I would like us to open our hearts and minds to, and this is just one thing recently appearing in the world, and I want to make a habit when we do bear witness that we don't bear witness to a long litany of terrible things, that we bear witness, that we take it in little doses, right? I was noticing, I was listening to a talk yesterday, and they were going on and on about stuff happening in the climate and ecological emergency. And after like the first one or two things, I was just like, I can't take in anymore. I can't process any more of that. So just one thing. So some of you may have read that there are signs that the Gulf Stream in the ocean is, it has been slowing down, and that it may collapse, it may stop. It's at its slowest point in 1600 years, and I don't know when it might stop, but this is a really, really big deal. And I did a little reading on it just to get a sense of it. So I'm no expert, but the Gulf Stream is part of a whole series of ocean currents, which essentially modulate our entire Earth's climate. So the Gulf Stream is part of what, keeps the cold and the warmth cycling, so that frankly, the Eastern North America and Western Europe stay warm. The last time these currents slowed down or stopped, there was a 1,000 years of ice age in North America and Europe. And then, of course, like this disrupts other things. This disrupts rain patterns and everything. So this article that I read, the expert just says, we don't know exactly when it's going to happen, but he just says, it's something you just can't allow to happen. So I just wanted to take a moment to, in our practice of bearing witness, we set aside for a moment the question of, is there anything we can do? Is there anything we should do? Whatever. We just set that aside for a moment, and we're just facing this and being at home with ourselves and our bodies, and considering what this what this might mean to our human civilization, our responses to it, and you know, when I the rest of what we're going to talk about today, I think is a helpful way to, I guess cope is one word, but it's to be able to live and thrive and respond appropriately. So on to today's topic, the medicine of suchness. So in Zen teaching, actually Chan teaching, so this predates the movement of our tradition to Japan. This arose in China. And it's really, and a large part this has to do, I believe, with the encounter of Buddhism with Taoism. So this is a very Taoist-informed way of viewing the world. That there are two truths. Reality has two dimensions, both of which are true simultaneously. And to summarize, for spiritual peace and liberation, equanimity, joy, we need to, it's extremely valuable to wake up to both dimensions. So the two truths are called many different things, absolute and relative, essential and contingent, conditioned and unconditioned, many and the one. But language is tricky. The words, any word that we choose fails to convey something or brings along some baggage that doesn't necessarily, that's actually inappropriate for the reality we're trying to convey. So it's essential to convey that these dimensions of reality are not two separate things. So a lot of times when we're talking about absolute and relative or something, it almost sounds like you can go into one of the realms, like in the absolute, blah, 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 in the relative, blah, 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 as if you could go into one dimension, you know, and not be in the other dimension. And they're not contradicted by one another. So the qualities of each dimension, which we're going to talk about, may appear contradictory when we describe them, but they're not contradictory. They're mutually dependent and simultaneous. So bear with me, because this can sound fairly philosophical, but it's really of practical and personal value. So I've thought a lot about this, and the language that I want to use, at least for now, is dependent and independent dimensions of reality. So it's one reality, it's just one, but it has different dimensions, right? So we can get our mind around, like, a physical object has three dimensions, right? And the fact that, you know, I have height does not contradict the fact that I have width. They go together. You can't have one without the other. And the fact that, you know, especially with regard to gravity, height has some qualities that width doesn't. So it's valuable to talk about height versus width. But you can't, like, well, when something is high, when something is tall, as opposed to it, the dimensions are like mutually dependent isn't in some ways is overstating the matter. They just are together. So the dependent dimension of reality we are fairly familiar with. This is the dimension of space and time. Because it's the dimension of space, it's the dimension of boundaries and differences. My body versus your body. I'm here in Oregon. You're there in New York or Brazil or where DC, wherever you are. We are in different places. I am short, you are tall. By their very nature, all differences and boundaries are relative. They're contingent, they're dependent. Short is relative to tall. In differentiating my body, I'm differentiating from everything else. So the definition of my body is dependent on the definition of everything else. So it's all tied together, relative, contingent. And because the dependent dimension of reality is also the dimension of time, it is the dimension of causation. What I do affects you. Everything we do has some result, which then functions as a new cause. And this dependent dimension of reality is not a lesser dimension. It's very true, and it's always true. No matter how profound your spiritual realization, this is a dimension of practice, of morality, relationship, love, learning, growth, birth, old age, disease, and death. It's also the realm of interdependence, which we can to awaken to more and more through our practice, through opening our hearts, because we recognize how incredibly interdependent we are. And challenge it challenges our cherished notions about us, separate, inherently existing self. So what if the dependent dimension has all this stuff, then what's left for the independent dimension? And this is where it gets tricky. Because language and concepts are part of the dependent dimension of reality. Using dependent tools to communicate about the independent dimension of reality is inevitably going to confuse the issue. Communication occurs in the dependent dimension. But what are we going to do? It is extremely rare for human beings to wake up to the independent dimension of reality, which I'm going to be talking about in a moment, or recognize the significance of it without being guided by other human beings. And we need to communicate in order to guide one another. So this is where we get that Chan and Zen image of the teaching is the finger pointing at the moon. So if I wanted to get you to have the experience of seeing the moon, I say, there it is. And you hopefully you follow the finger and you look at the moon. Oh, great, great. So you get to see it as well. But there is a tendency, we have a tendency sometimes to mistake the finger for the moon. Like we think the point is the finger and not using it to get our own experience of looking at the moon. So anyway, that's where we use language. It's the finger pointing at the moon. So that said, with that caveat, let's talk about the independent nature of reality. So to even call it a dimension is misleading because it has no dimension. The dependent dimension of reality is the dimension of space and time. Therefore, the independent dimension is not about space or time. So how can that be? Well, remember, we always, reality has its two dimensions, right? So we can't exist out of space and time. So perceiving the independent dimension of reality does not mean like that suddenly we don't exist in the dependent dimension of reality, right? We're always grounded in space and time. So that's not a problem. But when we perceive or take refuge in the independent dimension of reality, we forget about space and time. Or More accurately, for a moment, space and time are no longer front and central the way they usually are. There's only right here, right now. You are a pivot point of aliveness. And reality is a seamless whole. Shunryu Suzuki Roshi called this things as it is. And he wasn't a native English speaker. He was a native Japanese speaker. So you could look at that grammatical error in that phrase as being just a mistake. But I would think if it is a mistake, it's a significant mistake. Because that things as it is captures that sense that we're talking about all this stuff, but as one seamless reality. So right here, right now, has no reference point. It's not compared to anything. So no matter how terrible our situation may be in a dependent sense, it isn't terrible right here, right now. Things are just as they are. Because space is irrelevant, so are boundaries. The sound of the bird or the traffic outside your window is not separate from you. The breeze and the suffering child on the other side of the world from you is part of the same reality as you. In a way, it's not that there's no self, it's that everything is self. Everything is in motion together. And the trajectory is not the point. So I was thinking this is almost like we've been seeing a lot of these lately because of the Olympics. If you captured a gymnast in midair, in mid-flip, like we're in motion, but like I'm right here, right now, it doesn't matter where we're going. Along the independent dimension of reality, it makes no sense to discuss good and bad, because that's about comparison and causality. Questions of how good a person you are or how good your practice is are utterly meaningless. And I was trying to think of a good analogy for this, and I thought, I don't know, it's like applying for a job and then asking the interviewer whether it matters that, you know, as a child, once you had a bad haircut. It just doesn't matter. It's totally irrelevant. So setting aside for a moment how you manage to perceive this independent dimension of reality, what's so important about it? Why seek it? Why is it relevant? Especially if it's like good and bad and relationships and stuff don't really matter there. It sounds like it could be kind of negative or nihilistic. So here's the incredible thing that Buddhists have discovered. And the reason that it's important to keep the practice alive and share it with others. So things as it is, that independent, dimensionless dimension of reality, right here, right now, is amazing, miraculous, healing, indescribably beautiful, sustaining, and impossibly intimate. We might imagine in some whatever sense there is that there's no you versus me, and therefore even the concept of love is irrelevant, that it would be a nihilistic void, kind of bleak. Without dependent value or characteristics, there would be no meaning. But it's just not the case. Not at all. Things as it is needs no reference points or justification. Existence, life itself, is a profound miracle. And we as individuals are irreplaceable participants in it. We hold each of us an utterly unique place. It doesn't have to be like a special or better place, but it's we are part of. If we suddenly didn't exist, reality as a whole would be different. So one word we use for this kind of radiant quality of the independent dimension of reality is suchness. So without comparison, without judgment, inherently things are such. And such is a by definition, a fundamental intrinsic or characteristic quality or condition. And sometimes it's also called thusness. And suchness is not bleak or stark or meaningless. It's like universal liveliness. Now, as soon as we conceive of suchness, we start concretizing it. We make it a thing. Have you perceived suchness or not? What did it look like? Do you walk around in the dependent nature of reality or the independent nature of reality? We get confused and embroiled in our dependent thinking. Suchness cannot be captured or defined, but it definitely can be experienced. That experience is a profoundly invaluable medicine for our emotional, psychological, and spiritual ills. It's an antidote to despair, an antidote to depression, anxiety, self-judgment, fear, anger, all the rest. It's incredibly grounding because it gives us a place to stand that is completely independent of conditions. It's inspiring and encouraging because we can appreciate how life, no matter how it turns out, is a miracle. We feel gratitude and belonging. Fortunately, perceiving the independent nature of reality is not a superhuman spiritual attainment. It doesn't take great striving. That's not about straining to pierce through the veil of dependent reality to some secret dimension. But it's not necessarily easy to perceive it either, because it requires us to relinquish, at least momentarily, our preoccupation with the dependent dimension of reality. We have to momentarily let go of what and who and where we are and what we're doing. We have to let go of dwelling on past and worrying about the future. We have to let go of perceiving ourselves in relationship to everything, my job and my family and what I want and all this stuff. So this is where the term emptiness comes in. We say things are empty of inherently existing self-nature. We are empty in the dependent and the independent sense. So in the independent dimension, like I was saying, we're infinitely interdependent with everything else and everyone else. And therefore, we have no like inherent independent self-essence. And because of time, everything's always changing. And in the independent dimension, there's no separation. There's no separate you who would have an inherent self-nature or want to hold on to it. Waking up to emptiness is recognizing the absence of something you assumed was there. And then that opens you up to perceiving suchness. So everything is empty. Therefore, look around. How are things? Oh, thus such. So how do we work on perceiving emptiness and opening to suchness? And we practice this in our zazen, just repeatedly loosening our grasp on the dependent aspects of our existence in order to be right here, right now. And this doesn't have to be a strained thing, right? This is just when we notice we're grasping on to those dependent dimension. We just, you know, open the hand of thought. And that very thing raises the question, huh? You know, I'm not, this isn't the only aspect of reality. We also challenge our ideas of reality by studying the teachings, listening to talks, discussing the Dharma with others. I like to say that the Dharma is about challenging the ideas you have, not giving you new ones. So the teachings help, I like to say it's like positive brainwashing. It's like washing your mind, you know, by choice. And throughout the day, we can hold the question of that independent dimension of reality. During retreat, we set aside as many dependent concerns as possible and try to just give us lots of time to settle into right here, right now. But our perceptions of the independent dimension of reality may come up at any time. Just yesterday, in our Sangha check-in, we had somebody just beautifully describe a moment like this. Our practice simply lays the groundwork and opening us up. You may be looking at a sunset. You may be listening to your child read a story or holding a mug of tea or falling asleep at night. Generally speaking, the moment itself is utterly mundane. And describing it to others can sound kind of ridiculous or unremarkable. I was riding the bus and suddenly I realized I wasn't separate from any of the other people riding the bus. Or as I watched the steam rise from my cup of tea, I knew everything was just as it should be. And a typical response to somebody, you know, if you told this to somebody, might be like, oh, that's nice. But it's as if you just had a nice thought. But a person of practice will recognize the significance of this experience. For a moment, you perceived suchness, a truth about reality that is every bit as true as the dependent dimension we're usually focused on. And you can't hold on to these moments of perceiving suchness, but that's okay. They change us forever. Just one moment can sustain us for many years, if not a lifetime. Especially when we recognize and honor its significance. Especially when we say, it's not just like you had some random thought or the chemicals in your brain made you feel happy for a minute. We say, no, that is real. You perceived something real. So before I end, just a note on, I wanted to call this a medicine, the medicine of suchness. So if we can have some access to this medicine, then even in the midst of facing terrible things, we have a place, we have a way of accessing some strength and gratitude, of stepping outside of the sea of dependent concerns, which can be so stressful, and just right here, right now. However, it's like a medicine in the sense that it can be misapplied. So a note on using it using it appropriately. So both dimensions are simultaneously true. Like an object exists in three spatial dimensions. So there's no such thing as a two-dimensional object in terms of space. And the fact that I'm 5 feet 2 inches tall does not contradict the fact that I'm 1 foot thick. I have to be both. So it's similarly, it makes no sense to say in the dependent dimension, such and such is the case. In the independent dimension, such and such is the case. As if you can leave one dimension and go into the other and function over there for a while. Or that if you haven't had a conscious, remarkable experience of awakening to the independent dimension, that you only exist in the dependent dimension. You know, wish you could access the independent dimension, but you haven't had that luck so far. It's like, well, it's still part of your existence. So this is the kind of dualistic thinking that is inevitably caused by language and concepts. So it's incredibly useful to recognize the different qualities of each dimension and be able to live in a way that acknowledges and is in harmony with both. So to use the medicine of suchness in a negative way, and this may sound far-fetched to you, but it happens, is to deny the need to behave morally and carefully. There's in the independent dimension, there is no good or bad. There is no you or me. So I can sleep with my students and it doesn't matter if I steal from people. And I can turn a blind eye to suffering beings because I don't even really exist. So this is like saying, well, I can walk out on a highway without concern because I only exist in two dimensions. So we need to be careful about using the medicine of suchness in such a way. If we use it as a way to cope with or dull our grief or fear or pain for our own sake, we may conclude perhaps that this moment right here, right now, it's precious no matter what. Therefore, in the midst of the annihilation of global human civilization, it'll also be precious no matter what. And therefore, that annihilation isn't a problem. We can just go on enjoying our lives and we'll just rely on the medicine of suchness when things fall apart. But all the way along, the dependent dimension is also going to be true. And our well-being is intimately tied to that of every living being on this planet, every living thing on this planet. And to kill is to kill the Buddha. So if we deny that aspect of our lives, that dimension of our lives, we'll only be half alive. But when we get caught up in anguish and fear, whether this is personal or when we consider the wider world, when despair is knocking at the door, or it's already settled on our chest, the medicine of suchness can save our life. We can take a few breaths, center ourselves in our bodies, and recall the independent dimension of reality. Things as it is, in all of its luminous suchness, where existence itself is a miracle. So that's all I'll say on the topic. Open it up to comments and questions. Go ahead and unmute yourself if you like, or digitally raise your hand by using the reactions button down at the bottom, and I can call on people in order. I don't have my screen set to see everybody. Hold on for a minute while I be able to see everybody. There we go. Katie.
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
I just, you know, I it makes what you were talking about kind of maybe reminded me of like Tony
Yeah, I
Robbins.
guess talk a little closer to your microphone, probably.
Reminded me of Newtonian physics as opposed to, you know, modern physics and how, of course, they both happen at the same time. It's not like you're exempt. It's not like you enter different but also that ocean system thing is in the newspaper, the Oregonian. They put it on the very last page of the front section, which is page A28, and it's like the weather section. So it's kind of like they put it on as if it's like this little oddity of, you know, I'm just like, I was thinking about writing them a letter, so maybe they'll inspire me to follow through on that and just say, isn't this a little more important than that? So.
Thank you. Phil.
I want to thank you for this talk because after last week's talk, I was feeling like a little like overwhelmed, and so this really balanced out that last talk for me. So thank you very much. And I did a little research, and I ended up getting some dryer balls. Apparently, that's something good to do for the environment. So thank you.
Yeah, I that's what I hope is that that we bring more of the climate and ecological emergency into our consciousness, but you know there ha the and do that balance. So I'm glad to hear that. Was this just
Again,
go ahead, Mick.
so can you talk for a minute a little bit about, like, I guess living in the relative world and how to, like, I guess keep that in context. And to me, that's always what the precepts have kind of meant. You know, it's sort of like, hey man, this is what people who get it, this is how you can sort of like maybe start to see things in the relative world without kind of forgetting the absolute nature of it. But I don't know. I just figured I would ask.
Oh, I think that's a great point. So we're, in a way, we are looking to open ourselves up to like a personal perception of this, what I'm calling, right, the independent dimension of reality, because it is so strengthening and transformative and inspiring. But the other aspects of our practice aren't just because dependent and independent, you know, they're two dimensions, right? So in the ones like you might look at as more like dependent aspects of our practice, I think you summarized it great. They are, if nothing else, it's like you fake it till you make it. You're like, at least you act like you're living in harmony with both realities. And oftentimes in doing that transforms us as well. Maybe not in quite the same way, but so do people like my dependent, independent dimension phrasing? I don't know how many of you are just like kind of new to the whole absolute relative blah 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 discussion. Or if this is a interesting take on it and you're familiar with it. I'm guessing there are moments out there. I'm describing the, you know, watching the steam rise from your mug. Marv.
On that last question, I'm really glad you came up with a word other than absolute. Because it always bothered me that it's kind of anthropocentric. What we consider as absolute is not necessarily universally absolute. I've been toying with the idea of in terms of wisdom, of like the highest wisdom that we can get. But I think I like yours a lot better, because it doesn't put any greater value. There's so many people, when they talk about the absolute, they talk about it as truth, and therefore the relative must be false. Especially in my experience with Vajrayana, it's like that. And as you've taught, especially when you dealt with Dogen, that we can't accept that. So by putting terms on it, like dependent and independent, that don't ever suggest one is better than the other, I think that's fantastic.
Thank you. I was playing, you know, because I think the problem, I really liked, so Ross Bolliter wrote a book on the five ranks, and he called it essential and contingent. And I liked contingent. I really liked contingent. But the problem is primarily, I think it's the term for what I'm calling the independent nature of reality, because if you call it essential, now it's a thing. It's essence. It's something special. An absolute sounds so grand. And, you know, so all of those were, I kind of like, I almost wanted to say contingent and non-contingent. But then I figured, well, how about dependent and independent? Because they're relative to each other. It's not, yeah, one holy truth. And then, you know, here's the mundane world down here. Mark.
Go find my own mute button. I always like the principle and phenomena way of rendering it, because, you know, your brain happily jumps to principle as first and phenomena as dependent on principle and derived from principle. But you can also say no principle except as expressed by phenomenon. I keep trying to figure out if this is the same thing that Bankei is talking about when he talks about the unborn. As I always liked, he says, when you dwell in the unborn, all the time is zazen. I can experience that in short runs, but inevitably, you know, concerns about the phenomena pull me out of it. it's always seems like it's only a matter of time before I become convinced of phenomena again and lose track of the gestalt.
That's where, you know, I really do love the five ranks, even though once again, at first glance, that's a very philosophical thing, but it has very practical implications, because it describes how we perceive these as two different things. Like inevitably, when we first are delving into them, they feel like two different things. As I'm running around like my head, you know, chicken with my head cut off in this mundane world. And then every once in a while, I have a glimpse, you know, of something greater. But then I lose it and I'm going to run around again. So it feels very dualistic. But then, you know, it's pointing at like, they're never separate. They're always here at the same time. And therefore, but then we have to learn, okay, well, what does that mean? What does that actually mean in my daily life? What does that feel like? What does it feel like to honor both of these sides? So like to dwell in the unborn, I don't know. It sounds a little dualistic, right? It sounds like I'm going to go over here and just like walk around in the independent, you know, and I'm going to wander out in traffic because there is no being and no cars. But I guess the way that I'd like to think about it is there is greater and lesser familiarity with this independent dimension. And it's not an all or nothing thing. Every person here has tasted, has experienced, has glimpsed, has intuited this aspect of reality, unquestioningly. But we get, there's different degrees of familiarity. So you may have heard me use this analogy before, but it's like, let's say you're aiming to really, really, really become familiar with New York. You want to become like, you want to be a New Yorker. So, really familiar with the city and the territory and the culture and everything. So, you can start by reading some books about New York and you'll know something about it. And you can take a quick trip to New York and you'll know more about it. And you could live there for a while and know more about it. And the knowing is like more and more integrated, right? Like all you've done is read about New York and somebody starts asking you, yeah, well, how do you take Subway X to get to Brooklyn? And you might be like, oh shit, I haven't read that part. So you've reached the limit of your familiarity. But the more familiar you get, you can be like, oh yeah, well, I think you could, or you could take the bus over here, or you could but notice you're gonna, on this corner, you're likely to run into some people who are trying to sell you something. So like that's what I feel like. It's a continuum of familiarity that we're aiming to just, it ends up feeling less far away rather than like some rare, rarefied experience. It just becomes like it feels like it's just, you may forget it, but then it's more accessible. Jay, Soki. Jay, you wanna?
I couldn't tell that you had said my name.
Sorry.
So one thing that occurs to me is that I sometimes use the term for suchness as isness, I-S-N-E-S-S. And I find that the more I practice Nyoho and gathas throughout the day, just for the simple things like even a gatha for flushing the toilet, that helps me remember the isness of everything that I'm in touch with, that it's one and the same with me, it's not separate. And so where I'm working right now, it's very, very easy to get into a constricted place and do all that I'm asked to do from that constricted place. So I find myself, as I remember, telling myself, expand, and to remain in a grounded, expanded space, my isness space. And from there, remember, you can do all that you're being asked to do from this same exact place and have a totally different experience of how you're approaching it. So anyway, for me, it's also like the sense of expansion, setting the intention of grounded expansiveness from isness versus like getting constricted and going forward. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Oh, totally. Thank you for sharing. And it reminds me of, for me, I feel like the first time that I really got that, whatever the independent dimension wasn't something over there that some people had found and I hadn't found, and that it was relevant. It was relevant to right now. And it wasn't separate from the dependent. And I found this in Aikido. Because if you don't try to, you're not trying to anticipate. You're not trying to control. You're not trying. That's what I feel like. You have one foot in the isness, one foot in the independent reality. And then as things come at you, a response arises. And that is just so awesome. And generally our responses are more skillful and and take less stress and everything. So that's, I feel like that's a reflection of that, that kind of integration. So a few minutes, Brian.
Thank you. This, I think, will be a fruitful topic, this interdependence of the dependent and the independent realms. And, you know, in thinking about it, I was really reflecting on how much energy, you know, those episodes, brief, distant in time, perhaps, but how they really do permeate the ground of your being in a way, and then affect how you, you know, can move through even the more challenging parts of life. So I think it is, you know, a topic really worth reflecting on and tapping. So thank you for that.
Minutes left. Anything else? All right. Is that Marv trying to unmute yourself? There you go, Marv. Go ahead.
I'm not too sure about this question, but you know, you've given talks and podcasts before on relation of what has been called the relative and absolute. This time it was so much more sort of from the heart and moving. And I think that has something to do with the way you began in terms of the Gulf Stream and the climate crisis. So is there a point at which you're going to talk about different ways to look at that crisis through the dependent and independent?
I mean, maybe. I feel like, you know, everything is open season for discussion. You know, might not be specifically that crisis. I mean, Greece is on fire too. Like, there's no limit to the topics that can be brought in now. So yeah, I think just to be, you know, self-revelatory and honest. So I covered this a little bit last week, but, you know, I have been struggling for quite a few years now to find a way to, you know, bring my concern about the climate and ecological emergency and my Zen teaching together. And I couldn't find a way to do it. It seemed inappropriate or too specific, or I don't know. I guess the time wasn't right. I don't know. So more and more I felt compartmentalized. So I had this area of my life where I'm working in climate, and that is like, I wouldn't say that's where my heart is, as in my heart isn't in Zen, but sometimes Zen ends up feeling like, all right, well, let's pretend there's nothing going on in the world and we're just here to feel good. And that's not, I mean, there's time to take care, right? There has to be some of that, but it was cutting off some of my heart and inspiration and creativity to have to kind of compartmentalize it like that. So hopefully I could skillfully find a way to bring those things together. And, you know, I don't know. I hope that both my climate work and my Zen work will be better because of it. And let's see, we're at 12:15, but Pat, do you have something quick?
I want to say that the getting engaged, my notes say taking action and it's crossed out and it's saying getting engaged, but I'm not sure that I think that's solved it yet. But taking action was like a pee under my mattress, and at least it's a little bit easier, this getting engaged. Thank you for that.
Well, I mean, if you have any ideas, send them to me. Oh. Hello. All right. I will wrap it up with our verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. Thank you everyone for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Romeo.
Hey, Mick.
Thank you.
Oh, I hung up.
May I say something to you, Romeo, before you go?
Sure.
Thanks. Should I start or wait?
Up to you.
Okay, so about what you said about the compartmentalizing and, if I heard you correctly, something about Zen, to make you feel good. And yes, I would challenge that in that, at least for me, it doesn't make me feel good, but it helps me sit with what's uncomfortable and hard in a way that's more caring. And I guess it also helps get me to remain in that or reconnect with that place of isness rather than, and the discomfort may not go, the challenge may not go, but my relationship changes. That's all I really wanted to say.
Well, and I don't think, frankly, that you're one of the people that comes expecting that Zen or practice is going to be a distraction from your pain. Like, you know, and so I'm not saying anybody is necessarily completely in this category, but, you know, there is a certain sense that, like, look, when I come to my Zen group, I don't want to hear about this depressing stuff. You know, I want to, like, let's study some, you know, inspiring teaching or something like that, yeah, exactly. So there's a time and a place for that, right? I think we have this practice as powerful practices and tools to help us be more real with stuff. But there is, yeah. So it kind of like, I feel uncomfortable enabling spiritual bypassing. All right. Have a good one.
Thank you.